especially preschool-age children, who are not yet necessarily able to articulate their feelings in a clear way. Depression is usually inferred primarily from a sense of the child's outward demeanor, how sad his face looks, or mood. That is, through the child's conduct, especially acting out or problems with disobedience, or through complaints about physical problems, such as headaches or stomach aches. In children of school age up to and including the prepubescent years, features such as mood disturbance, irritable behavior, and more adult-like sadness are also considered. In addition, both preschool and prepubescent children may express feelings of worthlessness, low self-esteem, and a type of apathy or lack of pleasure called anhedonia. Finally, mental health professionals look for certain anxieties, phobias, and even the mention of suicide in children within this age range. In addition to the fact that this approach uses too narrow a set of symptoms to identify depression in boys, there's another problem. Making a diagnosis based on such criteria often depends on a patient's telling a clinician about his problems and the clinician's understanding and acting upon what the patient reports. Yet we know that boys and men minimize their problems, underreport their symptoms, and forget about troubles as soon as possible. We also know that medical professionals may actually collude with men's reluctance to see or discuss their feelings of sadness. In 1991, Potts, Burnham, and Wells from the RAND Corporation compared the way doctors diagnosed male patients suffering from depression-like symptoms to how these patients responded to a more objective and anonymous questionnaire, something called the Diagnostic Interview Schedule. The surprising result was that about 65% of the men diagnosed as healthy by the doctors were actually suffering from depression, according to their answers on the questionnaire. In other words, the physicians failed to catch over 3 out of 5 male depressions. Many depressed men don't tell their doctors about their troubles, and many doctors aren't asking the right questions or aren't hearing the answers men are giving them. Potts, Burnham, and Wells concluded that physicians are unlikely to press men about symptoms or to inquire in any depth once their male patients assure them that things are fine. Physicians, believing that they are helping men to avoid feelings of shame, go along with the code of silence. With boys, especially young boys, the dialogue between the child and his parent, physician, or other caregiver may be even more limited. The boy may not be able to find words to express his feelings, or the adult listening to the boy may not be closely enough attuned to the boy's subtle cries for help to realize how much the child is hurting. Given this important communication gap, and additionally if the adult is looking for symptoms that are more typical in women, such as sudden teary outbreaks, it's little surprise that depression in boys so often goes undetected and thus untreated. How do you tell if a boy is depressed? What type of criteria should we use to better diagnose boys who are depressed? I would propose creating a new diagnostic tool specifically designed to identify depression in boys. This would recognize that boys and men tend to act out depression through myriad behaviors, some of which look the same as those traditionally associated with depression in women, but many of which look different. Bearing in mind, too, that every depressed boy is likely to have symptoms that look different from those of the next boy, and that these symptoms will also vary depending on the specific age of the boy, I would recommend that we diagnose depression by watching carefully for the following symptoms. 1. Increased withdrawal from relationships and problems in friendships. Though a boy may deny that he's doing so, he may tend to spend less time than usual with friends and family. He may become further disconnected from them emotionally, acting more and more like something of a loner. He may stop talking and respond to questions reluctantly. At home, he may spend long periods of time in his own room, shrinking from interactions with other family members. At school, he may retreat from students and teachers and avoid participating in classroom discussions and activities. He may try to sit in the back of the room, sequester himself during recess or study breaks, and sit alone during lunch. He may try to avoid going to gym class, skip other courses, or become completely truant. When asked who his friends are, he may report that he has very few or none. He may seem unable to keep a best friend. This group of symptoms may appear in boys of all ages. 2. Depleted or impulsive mood. The boy may act tired, dispassionate, bored, depleted. He may stop showing interest or taking pleasure in activities he used to seem to enjoy. If normally he is vivacious and talkative, he may become increasingly sluggish, less talkative, and less outgoing. Alternatively, he may act impulsively, unpredictably, or irrationally. He may seem more anxious or fearful than usual, perhaps reporting to you that he feels nervous, worried, or tense. It's important for us to distinguish normal mood swings, especially during adolescence, from shifts in a boy's moods that reveal deeper problems. This is a subtle distinction, so I suggest parents err on the side of asking a boy how he's feeling, rather than simply dismissing or ignoring his mood changes. Note that depleted mood is a common symptom of depression in boys of all ages. However, the occurrence of impulsive mood increases with age. 3. Increase in intensity or frequency of angry outbursts. Even the smallest provocation may lead the boy to become full of rage and to verbally or physically lash out at others. What may at first seem to be a boy's tendency to be in a bad mood may escalate into temper tantrums or frequent outbursts of anger or ongoing irritability. It's important to remember that anger or being mad is one of the main ways boys indirectly express other feelings like grief, disappointment, and hopelessness. But when a boy becomes persistently angry or grouchy, he may very well be suffering a depression. Although the nature of a boy's angry outbursts may vary with age, this symptom is significant for boys of all ages. 4. Denial of pain. Even when questioned directly about difficult situations, a divorce, a death, an alcoholic parent, academic troubles, the boy may deny he's feeling unhappy. His mantra may be something like, "Everything's fine," or "What's the big deal?" or "Nothing's wrong, why are you bugging me?" Behind these hardened responses may be a frightened, hurting boy. It's important to probe behind the mask to help the boy express his authentic feelings. A boy in denial is often a boy in pain. He may also be severely depressed. Because this symptom is closely linked with the mask that emerges over time, it is unlikely to occur in preschool children, but with age, it may arise with increasing frequency. 5. Increasingly rigid demands for autonomy or acting out. The boy may say things such as, "Leave me alone." He may resist adult authority. Younger boys may resist following rules at home or at school. They may act out in the classroom or at home. Older boys may come home late, take long drives alone, and resist participating in family events, even locking themselves in their rooms, or following family rules, such as curfew or lights out. While sometimes the boy may simply be rebellious or working through the normal process of individuation, he may in reality be isolating himself to cope with depression. Studies have confirmed that many boys who are depressed tend to develop conduct disorders. In 1986, Denise Candle and Mark Davies, at the Department of Psychiatry at Columbia University Medical School, found that for boys, depressed mood was associated with minor delinquency and school absences. In 1990, Jeff Mitchell and Christopher Varley at the University of Washington School of Medicine found that 25% of pre-adolescent boys who were depressed also had a conduct disorder, whereas none of the pre-adolescent girls did. It's important not to see boys who misbehave as bad or toxic. They may be sensitive, thoughtful boys who are actually depressed. 6. Concentration, sleep, eating or weight disorders, or other physical symptoms. The boy may find it difficult to concentrate on any one task without becoming quickly distracted or uninterested, and might actually be diagnosed with attention deficit disorder. He may have trouble falling asleep, wake up abruptly in the middle of the night, or awaken prematurely in the morning. Alternatively, he may find himself tired a good deal of the time and sleeping too much each day. He may also suffer eating or weight disorders such as anorexia, bulimia, or obesity. These disorders do not happen only to girls. Also, he may have frequent headaches and stomach aches or report other persistent physical symptoms. Any of these problems with concentration, sleeping, eating, or maintaining body weight, or other physical symptoms, should be discussed thoughtfully with the boy, as they are frequently associated with depression and or may be connected with other serious medical disorders. In one form or another, these problems suggesting depression may occur in boys of any age. 7. Inability to cry. The boy may appear unable to cry. Thus, for instance, if he is physically injured or is obviously in the middle of an emotionally traumatic experience, he may fail to shed a tear, appearing more stoic and hardened than usual. When any boy shuts down his emotions in this way, he may be trying to numb out what are actually symptoms of depression. Tragically, research shows that this symptom can occur in boys as early as elementary school. 8. Low self-esteem and harsh self-criticism. The boy may seem very unsure of himself. He may utter self-effacing remarks such as, "I'm such a jerk," or "Nobody cares about me," and focus on his failures more than on his successes. He may blame himself for things that clearly are not his fault. When offered compliments, he may deny them and try to persuade others of his weaknesses and shortcomings. Low self-esteem can be both a cause and a result of depression in boys. When you determine that a boy doesn't feel good about himself, not only should you try to encourage and support him, but you should also make sure that his low self-confidence isn't linked to a more generalized sadness. Research has shown that this symptom can surface in depressed boys as early as the third grade. 9. Academic difficulties. Often closely linked with low self-esteem, the depressed boy may have problems doing well at school. His grades may plummet, and he may get a bad report insofar as his conduct is concerned. These problems may stem not only from his lack of self-confidence, but from his tendency to be distracted by his latent sadness. He may simply feel too unhappy to do his schoolwork, much in the way that an adult who is depressed may begin to have problems focusing on work-related obligations. Also, when a boy is depressed, he may experience general difficulties concentrating on any given task, become withdrawn and tired, and thus find it very difficult to apply himself to his classwork. This symptom can occur as early as the age when the boy leaves home to begin school. Ten. Over-involvement with academic work or sports. The boy may become almost obsessive about his schoolwork or sports activities. He may spend all his free time on homework, studying compulsively, or out on the playing fields, avoiding contact with friends or family. While working hard at school or playing sports are obviously positives, some boys may use such activities to distract themselves from depressive states, much in the way that men who are workaholics will use career-related work for such distraction. This symptom is more common as boys move toward adolescence. 11. Increased aggressiveness. The boy may exude an overabundance of aggressive energy. He may act wild, become difficult to control, pick fights, or even intentionally injure others. His aggressiveness may actually spiral into sheer violence. Aggressiveness, like anger, is an approach boys take to cover up vulnerable feelings. Again, it's critical that we do not rush to the conclusion that an aggressive boy is merely a boy who is bad and doesn't know how to behave. His rough behavior, especially if it becomes chronic and extreme, may actually be his way of calling for help. This symptom occurs in boys of all ages. 12. Increased silliness. Perhaps to mask his genuine feelings of sadness, the boy may actually act silly or outrageous. He may, even as a very young boy, become the class clown at school or become the family comic at home. As his self-confidence deteriorates, he may also have a tendency to become the brunt of other people's jokes. This is perhaps the most deceptive symptom of depression in boys. Not only does the boy seem to be doing all right, he seems amusing, entertaining, funny, but under the cheerful exterior may reside deep feelings of pain or depression. 13. Avoiding the help of others. The "I can do it myself" syndrome. When offered help on a task or given the chance to get emotional support from others, the boy will insist that he can handle things himself. This is another way in which the boy attempts to remove himself from the mainstream of his family and social circles and isolate himself. While a boy taking initiative should usually be encouraged, if he consistently or inappropriately protests others' offers to help him out, he may be falling into a withdrawn or antisocial behavioral pattern not atypical of depressed boys. As a boy begins to be oppressed by the boy code as early as the elementary school years, he may manifest this symptom of depression. 14. New or renewed interest in alcohol or drugs. In older boys, there may be a tendency to become more and more involved in alcohol or drug use. A boy who might have enjoyed a beer from time to time may begin spending time with friends who drink until they're drunk. He may smoke marijuana regularly or begin experimenting with more serious drugs. Nearly 1 million eighth graders say they have gotten drunk, according to a 1997 survey of 1,115 teens. This survey also found that 56% of those between the ages of 12 to 17 have a friend or classmate who has used LSD, cocaine, or heroin, up from 39% in 1996. Sadly, many of these self-destructive behaviors are considered cool by teenagers and can confer social acceptance on a boy, a valuable benefit for a lonely, disconsolate boy. Such excessive use of drugs and alcohol is a classic sign of depression in boys and men and appears to be occurring in children of younger and younger ages. 15. Shift in the interest level of sexual encounters. In older teenagers who are sexually active, there may be either a pronounced increase or decrease in his dating behavior or sexual activity. While obviously a healthy adolescent libido does not generally lead to depression, a boy who exhibits radical changes in his sexual behavior may be engaging in obsessive-compulsive behavior that reflects depression. 16. Increased risk-taking behavior. During the teenage years, the boy may begin to take inappropriate or unnecessary risks that show poor judgment. Examples include a new and unexplained tendency to engage in unprotected sexual activity, to drive at excessive speeds, or to engage in such sports as extremely risky skiing or bungee jumping that have high morbidity rates. 17. Discussion of death, dying, or suicide. Especially during adolescence, but in some cases as early as the elementary school years, boys who are depressed may initiate discussions of or make casual or even joking references to death, dying, or suicide. While a child's curiosity about his own mortality, or that of others, is only natural, it's important to listen closely to any boy who talks about these issues. Especially if he's exhibiting some of the other symptoms of depression, his reference to death, dying, or suicide may actually be an indirect way of letting others know that he's not feeling good about himself, that he may be depressed. It's always better to be wary, to question him about such a reference, even if it turns out that he was simply curious or trying to be humorous. While it would be extremely rare for any boy who is depressed to exhibit all of these symptoms, it may also be unlikely that he'd exhibit just one. Typically, several of these symptoms will appear in a boy who is depressed. Yet because depression occurs along a continuum from mild to severe, I think it's important to take immediate steps to help the boy as soon as any of the symptoms outlined above are detected. With depression, it's better to be safe than sorry. Chapter 13. Violence. Slay or be slain. You better know how to fight. If you don't, people will just walk all over you. Dean, age 11. It begins with this connection, the roots of male violence. Today, most violence in our society is perpetrated by young males against other young males. Violence is the most visible and disturbing end result of the process that begins when a boy is pushed into the adult world too early and without sufficient love and support. He becomes seriously disconnected, retreats behind the mask, and expresses the only acceptable male emotion, anger. When a boy's anger grows too great, it may erupt as violence. Violence against himself, violence against others, violence against society. Violence, therefore, is the final link in a chain that begins with disconnection. Violence is also about shame and honor. For many boys, failing to know how to fight, or refusing to fight when challenged to do so, may be considered disgraceful, a sign of dubious masculinity. By learning how to fight and striking out against others who may be younger, weaker, or less skilled at combat, our young aggressor attempts to respect old boy code rules that call on him to do everything possible to protect his honor and prevent shame. We've already spoken of a boy's exquisite sensitivity to shame and the toughening up he does to protect himself against it. Violence, of course, is a boy's attempt to go yet one step further, to thwart shame and dishonor by going on the offensive, by hurting another human being. Ironically, violence in boys also sometimes represents a vain attempt on their part to reconnect with others, to make and keep friends. Whether it's winning a fight and thus impressing one's peers, helping other boys to beat up another kid, or actually joining a gang, violence may give some boys a false impression that they're somehow growing closer to one another, bonding, in effect, through their individual and collective acts of aggression and malevolence. We've spoken of how sports can be transformative, enabling boys in a positive, healthy way to express a wide range of emotions, bond as friends, and boost their feelings of self-esteem. For some boys, violence is an unhealthy and, of course, futile attempt to gain similar social benefits. A world of violence. Most of us think that violence is about other people's children. We think of violence as a netherworld occupied by street criminals, gang members, serial killers, vicious rapists, the dregs of society, not our children or the children of people we know. But talk with almost anyone, and eventually you will uncover some incidents of violence that has touched someone in or close to his or her family. The lawyer uncle who committed suicide. The son at the prestigious university who was mysteriously murdered. The marketing manager who was seriously injured in a late-night car crash. The family friend who was accused of physically abusing his wife. The 9-year-old who was killed in a bicycle accident. The 4 unsuspecting students and their teacher killed in cold blood one Tuesday morning, allegedly at the hands of 2 young Arkansas boys. The fact is that we all live in a world of violence, and that our boys are particularly vulnerable to its many manifestations. Only a small percentage of boys perpetrate or participate in the worst sort of violence, violent crime, or are direct victims of it. But every one of them is a witness to extreme violence of one kind or another, in school, on the street, in the news, on television programs, in the movies, at the computer, in books and magazines, and, sadly too often, at home. Most parents of boys will have to contend with the issue of violence very early in their sons' lives, just as every boy must contend with it himself. The challenge for parents is to understand the difference between action, which boys love, and violence, which most boys don't, and to learn how to help boys keep on this side of the line that separates the two. When does roughhousing get too rough? When does teasing become bullying? When does boldness cross the line into unnecessary risk-taking? As parents, we want to encourage our boys in their pursuit of action, but keep them from becoming part of the national statistics that pertain to violence in our society. We can do so through the potency of connection we've discussed throughout this book, by staying closely involved with our sons, teaching them how to handle the anger that can turn to violent rage, and imparting as much information as we can to help them avoid becoming victims of others' hurtful acts. A national crisis. The fact that most violence in our society is done by or to males will come as no surprise to most people. But what's alarming, and less well known, is that the violence that surrounds us in this country increasingly involves young men and boys. For example, consider a seemingly commonplace and non-lethal example. The American Medical Association determined that 1 in 10 boys has been kicked in the groin by the age of 16. 25% of those kicks result in an injury. We might shrug off this finding and assume that many of the kicks are unintentional or that they are simply part of normal boyish roughhousing and play. But the AMA also discovered that most boys don't tell their parents about the groin kick or the injury. And even more significant, about 25% of the injured boys exhibited signs of depression within a year after the injury. In other words, these boys did not consider a kick in the groin as just a routine part of boyhood. The event bothered them. They felt shame about the injury. They were disturbed by the violence, but felt they couldn't or shouldn't talk about it, so they hid their emotions behind the mask. Neither boy involved in the incident, the kicker or the one kicked, may end up as a spouse-beater or a gun-toting criminal, but both have experienced violence. Young men and boys also suffer a great deal of violence that falls into the category of risk-taking behavior gone wrong. Michael Kennedy, the sixth child of Robert Kennedy, was killed in late 1997 while playing a game of football on skis. Although he was 39, hardly a boy, when he slammed into the tree, he was engaged in the kind of violent boys-will-be-boys behavior that our society not only tolerates, but has come to respect, encourage, and even revere. Statistics show that Michael Kennedy was not alone. Although males account for about 60% of all skiers, 85% of all skiers killed are men. Although no crime was involved, no weapons, no malice of intent, Michael Kennedy was, in effect, a victim of violence. And, of course, one of the most tragic manifestations of male violence is self-mutilation and suicide. As we discussed earlier, in the United States, the suicide rate among 15 to 24-year-olds tripled between 1950 and 1990. And suicide is now the third leading cause of death within this age group. Among Americans of all ages, the rate of suicide among males is about four times the rate among females. Indeed, our boys and young men are at risk from all kinds of violence, from fighting and accidents, violent crime, murder, and suicide. The major causes of mortality and morbidity among teenagers have shifted from infectious to behavioral etiologies, writes Dr. C. Wayne Sells, a specialist with the Department of Pediatrics at the University of California. In other words, young people have more to fear from their own behavior than they do from disease. Here are a few statistics. 78% of all unintentional deaths of youth result from motor vehicle accidents. 75% of those are young men. About one-third of all victims of violent crime are 12 to 19 years of age. Homicides are the second leading cause of death among adolescents, accounting for 22% of all deaths among youths 14 to 25 in 1991. Males are more than 400% likely to be murdered than are females. Between 1979 and 1991, almost 40,000 kids aged 14 to 19 died from firearms. The firearms death rate among male teenagers aged 15 to 19 more than doubled from 1985 to 1994, reaching 49.2 deaths per 100,000, the highest level ever. As stated above, suicide is the third leading cause of death among people aged 15 to 24, and the rate of suicide within this age group has tripled from 1950 to 1990. Suicide among the very young, from age 10 to 19, has also increased significantly. The rate of suicide for males of all ages is four times that of the female rate. These facts demonstrate that young people have become increasingly involved in and vulnerable to violent crime, and that the young people most at risk are boys. Boys begin their involvement with violence very early. In fact, research shows that after the age of 2, boys get injured up to 4 times more often than girls. Parents simply come to expect their boys to use up more Band-Aids and make more trips to the emergency room than their girls. Yet, curiously, boys themselves take a rather blithe attitude toward injury. A Canadian study shows that boys tend to blame injury on bad luck rather than on any correctable circumstance, such as their own behavior. This tendency of boys to blame injury on external factors is also borne out by an intriguing study recently conducted by the Gillette Company that investigated the shaving habits of male and female adults. When a man cuts or nicks himself shaving, the study found, he generally blames the razor. When a woman draws blood, she tends to blame herself. But even if a boy never gets entangled in violent crime directly, as a perpetrator or a victim, as he probably won't, he still must find his way to healthy manhood in an environment that is replete with violence. It can start with the bully. For many boys, the earliest and most vivid experience with violence is provided by the school bully. Charlie is a child whose whole first grade year was made utterly miserable by a bully named Ben. Ben was a thoroughly modern bully. The bullies of the 1990s must operate differently from those of the 1950s. Overt and obvious physical aggression is not tolerated on many American playgrounds today. The child who pushes or slaps or kicks or punches is swiftly dealt with. The child who bites, in this age of AIDS, is considered a dangerous potential health hazard. Today's bullies have developed a subtler set of strategies that include ridicule, shaming, making others feel inadequate. So, rather than physical violence, Ben used primarily verbal weapons, the insult, the taunt, the jeer, but was skillful enough in wielding them that they caused Charlie great distress, even though he himself was seldom the victim of Ben's aggression. Seeing his classmates abused caused Charlie to develop a chronic stomach ache that sometimes kept him out of school or sent him home early. Charlie's mother identified Ben as the principal cause of Charlie's woes and resulting stomach aches, and alerted the classroom teacher. The teacher, however, was in her first year on the job and did not have enough experience to deal effectively with the problem. As a result, she downplayed Charlie's stomach aches and implied that he just needed to tough it out. Charlie and his parents worked on a number of strategies for dealing with the Ben issue, but the problem remained until summer finally came and Charlie escaped the bully for the beach. In fact, that was no solution at all. It merely provided a temporary escape. The fact is that the disruptive effect of the chronic bully can be a difficult problem for everyone involved in the situation— students, teachers, and parents, including the parents of the bully himself. But it can be alleviated and even solved, as we'll discuss later in this chapter. Bullies like Ben can cast a pall over an entire classroom and playground, and bullies remain a fixture on playgrounds throughout the world. In fact, the National Association of School Psychologists estimates that in the United States some 160,000 children miss school every day for fear of being bullied. One colleague told of a mother whose child was being tormented by a playground bully, but could get no action from the school authorities. So concerned was she for her child, she began hiding behind a shed on the school grounds, hoping to catch the bully in the commission of one of his crimes. But what causes a boy to bully or to allow himself to be bullied? Is a bully a naturally violent boy, or is he a boy desperate for connection who is only able to express his need through violent action? Is it action or violence? When thinking about boys and violence, it's essential to make a distinction between violent behavior and action behavior. Although most boys aren't violent, they often love physically vigorous activities, intense games, loud play, rough play. For the most part, however, that inclination to action does not cross over the line into violence. Most roughhousing ends abruptly when one of the participants gets hurt, a bump on the head, a twisted arm, or an elbow in the gut, and so does not escalate into a fistfight. Most teasing and joshing trails off without crossing over into physical violence. Most intense activities, such as sports, conclude with the participants exhausted and the players shaking hands rather than in a melee. In fact, sports, as I've emphasized, generally bring boys closer to one another. So what makes for the difference between an active boy and a violent one? In my opinion, there are virtually always important psychological factors that come into play. It's rarely just chance that escalates a boy's natural craving for action into an unnatural one for violence. In the case of Ben, Charlie's bully, the boy's parents had recently gone through a difficult divorce. Ben felt disconnected from his parents, the family he had once been part of, his friends, and his community. Ben also suffered from a learning disorder. He felt inadequate and ashamed, and he had just moved to the town and knew few people. He felt alone and powerless and still more disconnected. Because his mother now had to work full-time and his father wasn't around, Ben got little help with these difficult emotions. Left on his own, trying to appear stoic, he channeled all his fears into anger and aimed it at his classmates. Interestingly enough, however, Charlie was, in fact, an unusually empathic child. He liked Ben when he wasn't in his bully mode, and even accepted invitations to his house to play. Perhaps, in some way, Ben was asking for connection and empathy, and recognized Charlie as a boy who might be able to give it to him. As explained above, in some cases, boys like Ben perpetrate violence not because they want to injure others, but rather because they believe it will somehow win them friendship and approval from others. And sometimes the person they most especially desire to win over is not a co-aggressor, but instead their victim. Of course, a bully may be more likely to meet with retaliation by his victim than with friendship. Gordon, a 7-year-old African-American, was a frequent target of Leonard, the bully of his second-grade class. "Leonard is really mean to everybody," Gordon said. "He pulls girls' hair, he hits boys, and he spits on you. I hate him." When their class finished a unit on the history of African Americans, Leonard used what he had learned to add shaming to his bullying. When he encountered Gordon on the playground, he took to calling him slave. "At first I wanted to punch him," Gordon told me, "but I was afraid I'd get in trouble. I was going to tell on him, but I was scared he would get even worse to me after that." Gordon did not punch Leonard, nor did he go to his teacher with his problem. Instead, he endured the insults for several days, like a man, and then decided to confide in his mother. She listened with steadily growing fury, and then made her recommendation. "I told Gordon it was okay to slug Leonard," she admits. "There are some things that just aren't acceptable." So the next time Leonard called him a slave, Gordon punched him. Both boys were promptly hauled off to the principal's office, where the principal counseled Gordon that he should not use fists to solve problems. Leonard's parents were summoned. After a lengthy meeting, both Gordon and Leonard were sent home for the day. The next day, Leonard the bully had backed off. "He's still mean to me and everybody," Gordon said, "but he doesn't call me slave anymore." And Gordon pointed out that he had gotten a half-day off from school to boot. The mother's recommendation worked, but it didn't help to solve the long-term problem of either the bully or his victim. Plus, Gordon ended up with a confusing set of mixed messages. On the one hand, the principal delivered the message that violence is neither acceptable nor the best way to solve problems. On the other hand, Gordon gathered some overwhelming empirical data that, in fact, a solid slug at the right moment can sometimes provide a short-term solution to the problem. One thoughtful researcher into men's and women's anger, Jean Baker Miller, believes that this kind of violent behavior stems from fear. "Boys are made to fear not being aggressive," she writes, "lest they be found wanting, be beaten out by another, or worst of all, be like a girl. All of these constitute terrible threats to a core part of what is made to be men's sense of identity, which has been called masculinity." The phenomenon of which Miller speaks, in my opinion, affects boys in at least two central ways. First, it makes the potential instigator of violence more likely to leap into action. Rather than risk an affront to his honor or a blow to his sense of masculine self-esteem, the boy defends himself by going on the offensive, by lashing out at others. Second, this same fragility, the trepidation a boy feels about being shamed, about being considered less than a man, may lead the victim of other boys' violence to take the beatings in silence, even to smile and attempt to shrug them off. So if he does not tattle or retaliate, as, for example, Gordon did, he may instead try to bear the violence quietly to cover any outward signs that he is the victim, that he is too scared to take on the bully. As I've learned in my years of counseling men, many adult males would rather die than be shamed. So I suppose it should be little surprise that many boys feel similarly. In my view, today's boy bully is often, but not always, tomorrow's adult violent offender. Sometimes the high school bully learns to control his anger along the way to manhood, and former classmates, cautiously greeting him at their 20-year reunion, are stunned to find the young tormentor has turned into a charming and engaging adult. On the other hand, sometimes the quiet victim, the shy loner, or the troubled bystander, suddenly turns violent in an unexpected eruption of rage, either in later boyhood or as an adult. This might explain the case of the mild 14-year-old Kentucky high school student who in 1997 killed three fellow students with a rifle, much to the disbelief and incomprehension of his parents, teachers, and classmates. The question on everybody's lips at the time was, why? The boy had shown no signs of violent behavior. He was no bully. But clearly something caused him to snap. Such violent acts do not just happen. I believe that, among other things, it is shame that makes a boy like this snap. When enough shame collects inside of him, when he feels disconnected, unpopular, less than masculine, maybe even hated, the boy tries to master his feelings and reconnect with others through violence. The good news is that we now know a great deal about how shame fuels anger, what can trigger it to turn into rage and violence, and how to think about and behave with boys differently, so that they can feel better about their genuine selves, turn away from anger, avoid violent behavior, and still retain the qualities and pursue the activities that are most positively boy: the vigorous action, the productive intensity, the boldness of individual endeavor, the empathy found in group play and team sports. What can we do? First, we can understand why boys may harbor anger, and why their inclination for action and rough play may turn that anger into rage or violence. In Chapter 3, I talked about the biology of boys. I argued that many people base their thinking about boys on the myth that testosterone equals aggressiveness equals boys, but that nothing in the research, mine included, proves that equation to be true. We now see the old nature versus nurture debate as outdated and simplistic, and have come to understand that the behavior of boys results from a combination of biological and environmental factors. All boys are not biologically destined to be more aggressive than girls. Biology creates tendencies for boys and girls to behave differently, but it is not an absolute. In fact, all the behavioral qualities that we traditionally associate with girls, such as empathy, sensitivity, and compassion, are also basic male traits. Research shows that boys begin their lives with a natural sense of empathy, which is antithetical to violence. Boys as young as 21 months display a well-developed, natural, hardwired ability to feel empathy, including a wish to help other people who are in pain. And yet, as we discussed in Chapter 2 on shame and the trauma of separation, by the second grade, boys seem far less attuned to feelings of hurt and pain in others, and begin to lose their capacity to express their own emotions and concerns in words. This, of course, is the self-hardening boys do when they begin to feel society's pressure to avoid feelings and behaviors that might bring them shame. This is the process that pushes boys to wear a mask of bravado, and this, in large part, is what makes them violent. And so the statistics show that violence is overwhelmingly a male thing. Young men are violent with other young men, with young women, and with themselves. Most violent behavior is and always has been the work of men, writes James Gilligan. It is clear that both cross-culturally and trans-historically, men have been the more violent sex. So, why do men behave so much more violently than women do, if there is no male violence chromosome? The answer, again, lies in the themes we have been discussing throughout this book. When boys feel disconnected and afraid of being shamed, when they harden themselves and then put on the macho mask, the one emotion they feel it's acceptable to show, and thus the only emotion that they will show, is anger. That anger can come out as risk-taking behavior, or, as I sometimes call it, death-oriented bravado. The boy has such a phobia of showing his shame that he counteracts it or overcompensates for it by showing its opposite: recklessness and risk-taking and even violence against himself. That anger can easily turn to violence against others when the right factors are present or come into play. We had a glimpse of some of these in the story of Ben, the first-grade bully. There is generally a triggering event for any violent act, a threat, a betrayal, or an insupportable loss. The man who loses his job and goes on a shooting spree. The teenager whose girlfriend dumps him for somebody else and beats her up. The second grader whose friend excludes him from a party or special event and screams at his mother. Whether the boy engages in risk-taking behavior or commits violence against others, it is often fueled by a reservoir of anger, fear, and shame that has gradually accumulated over the years since the trauma of separation from his parents. A group of Danish doctors conducted a study to try to determine a link between early disconnection from the mother and adult behavior. They found that individuals who suffered both birth complications and early childhood rejection were most likely to become violent offenders in adulthood. But if these unlucky guys were most likely to become violent offenders, I believe a boy need not suffer birth complications or outright rejection by his mother to feel the loss of being prematurely pushed out into the man's world. As we've seen, the push to disconnect is ubiquitous. It comes not only from parents, but from peers, other adults, and from our popular culture in general. From a very early age, the boy is thrust out into the world and placed in what we've seen is a painful, shame-inducing male straitjacket. Throughout boyhood, the strings are pulled tighter and tighter until either the straitjacket snaps or the boy does. On the frontier. One way to think about our boys today is that they exist on a kind of frontier. Writers and historians, and our own intuition and experience, tell us that the frontier, any frontier, is generally a more violent place than civilization, the world of cities and towns and well-established communities. The American West has long been considered the quintessential violent frontier, and the American cowboy the quintessential example of the true man, laconic, tough, self-contained, unemotional, and above all, action-oriented. Countless legends and songs and books and movies and television programs have helped to create and sustain the image of the lone man surviving on the wild and violent frontier, the Marlboro Man. When I was growing up in the 50s, the macho hero was generally a cowboy or a ranger or a lawman. John Wayne in Stagecoach and The Searchers. Gary Cooper in High Noon. They didn't say much. They focused on an active mission to get the bad guys. Women were, for the most part, a distraction, if a necessary and sometimes pleasant one. Emotion was expressed haltingly. Vulnerability and weakness could get you killed and fast. The father, if he hadn't already been shot or eliminated in some other violent way, expected his son to wrangle the horse or wrestle the bully or shoulder the rifle as soon as possible, with no whining and without much instruction. For boys, these images of the frontier can be immensely powerful, even if they don't think of themselves as particularly violent or imagine themselves as future cowboys. Of course, the West is currently pretty much out of vogue, but the idea of the frontier and its stereotype of the lone, violent male hero continues to provide the setting for some of our most popular media. The current favorite frontier is outer space, with aliens now taking the roles of the bad guys. I believe one of the reasons boys find the frontier so appealing is that they feel they are inhabiting a kind of emotional and physical frontier of their own. They are made to feel isolated from one another. They feel disconnected from their families. They are admired and rewarded for physical strength and emotional courage, while physical weakness and emotional vulnerability are ridiculed. On the frontier, risk-taking behavior is commonplace. It should be no surprise that boys who are forced to live on such a frontier act out the role in real life by punching, shooting, or taking a risk that leaves them dead. Male and female stereotypes at school. that traditional stereotypes for boys and girls, men and women, endure in the classroom as well as in the popular media. Teachers and parents bemoan the fact that gender dynamics at school are hardly different than they were 40 years ago. 40 years? Try 40,000, writes Lawrence Cohen in an article called Hunters and Gatherers in the Classroom. Indeed, for all the progress we have made in changing attitudes and redefining roles for men and women, particularly women, it seems that the most basic of stereotypic behaviors linger on in the classroom. Boys roughhouse, girls playhouse, writes Dr. Cohen. He describes asking 2 6-year-olds, a boy and a girl, what makes a child popular? The girl said, being nice, having a lot of good ideas, being smart. The boy said, shooting missiles. Boys are admired by their peers for physical prowess. Who can run fastest? Who can kick the soccer ball farthest? Who can ring the bell first at the top of the climbing rope? As well as intellectual vigor and prowess at verbal sparring. Boys also can gain admiration, or at least notoriety, through acts of daring. Who dares cross the street, not at the crosswalk? Who dares jump over a ditch? Who dares talk with the strange janitor? Who dares eat a sandwich made of peanut butter, salami, and ketchup? Who dares bring a knife to school when it's strictly forbidden? Who dares kill a stranger? Girls, however, tend to gain status through building and maintaining relationships, being nice and sociable, dressing well and looking good, participating in class, speaking articulately, scoring well on tests, reading difficult books, pleasing the teacher. In other words, boys are constantly being rewarded by their peers and even by their teachers and parents for behavior that fits the traditional male stereotype. The stereotypes apply to insult and ridicule and bullying, as well as to admiration and reward. As soon as a kid steps out from behind the mask, as soon as he defies the old boy code, he may encounter trouble. Boys who act like girls may be labeled sissies or babies. Boys who can't fight or who won't fight may be relegated to the bottom of their peers' friendship hierarchy. As 11-year-old Dean warned me, "You better know how to fight. If you don't, people will just walk all over you." And so boys harden themselves, learn how to fight, and give themselves over to society's stereotyped vision of how they should behave. And yet, as prevalent as these stereotypes are, there are lots of kids, maybe even the majority, who do not fall prey to them. There are plenty of boys who show empathy with one another, who back away from violence when things get out of hand, who talk with one another about their thoughts and emotions, who accept a wide range of people with a wide range of behavioral, physical, and cultural differences. How do they become that way? Many of them say, "It's my friends that get me through." As Preston, age 13, explained to me when I asked him how he deals with kids who fight and act violently, "It's not so much about fighting. It's about standing up for yourself and for your friends." So just as peers can join together into a violent gang, they can also support one another in resisting society's stereotypes, finding their own path, and avoiding violence. In other words, the prevention for violence can be found in connection with friends, with family, with parents. Making connections and providing models. People who care about others and feel connected to them are rarely the ones who allow their anger to get out of control or commit acts of violence. A boy who is cared about will be more likely to care about others. If he feels connected to his parents and his family, he will feel more connected to other people. If he feels that his parents understand him and empathize with him, he will have the ability to do the same with others. The difficulty for many parents is that it is not always an easy task to find the best way to express caring for their boy child or to make and keep a connection with him, especially as the child goes through adolescence. Most boys respond to hugs and kisses, but not always in public. Most boys respond to parents when they praise them, but not if the praise seems excessive or unwarranted. Some boys want to be active with their parents, to go swimming, or to the supermarket, or to the movies. But others need less active contact. Fathers may do fine doing things together, but also need to recognize when the boy only requires that the father be there and take full notice of what his son is up to. We've heard a lot about parents who fail to attend the big baseball game or the recital or the school play, and how disappointing that can be to the boy. But we've also seen parents who do make it to the big event, and then spend most of their time on the cell phone or reading the newspaper. The point is, that boy knows when the parent is truly involved and genuinely cares, and when he or she is merely going through the motions. No parent is perfect, and every child's threshold of need is different, but there is a kind of running tally being kept in every boy's head. When the debits outweigh the credits, the boy starts to feel deprived of love, nurturing, and caring. That's when he begins to focus more on his own needs than those of others. That's when he starts to feel anger. That's when all his vulnerable feelings may funnel into rage, and when his rage may bubble over into violence. So it's what the parent does and how the parent behaves that is most important. A parent or teacher may talk about caring and the importance of being empathic until he or she is blue in the face, but if they don't act with empathy themselves, the talk is meaningless. The best way for parents to help their boys express their emotions and avoid anger and rage is also the most difficult. They must provide a model for their children in the way they themselves behave. Parents are good at telling a boy not to shout, not to hit, not to tease or ridicule others. But all those reasonable and time-honored lessons are instantly negated as soon as the father gets angry and kicks a chair himself, or the mother describes a neighbor boy who acts like a baby, or both parents get in an argument that ends with the father slamming out of the house and the mother insulting him as he storms out of the driveway. Linda found that her 10-year-old son, Jonah, was translating his father's actions into his own violent behavior at school. As early as age 3, Jonah had begun behaving aggressively, and she would receive calls from the daycare center complaining that he was biting other kids. I'd tell him to stop it, and I'd give him time outs like everyone suggested, but it just kept getting worse. By the time Jonah reached 4th grade, Linda had grown accustomed to getting the calls. Jonah gave so-and-so a black eye. Jonah knocked so-and-so's tooth out. I didn't know what to do. I never thought I'd be the mother of a violent kid. Finally, Linda set up a meeting with Jonah's teachers and the school psychologist. Together they probed for possible causes for Jonah's behavior. It was very, very hard to admit, she told me, but I had to face it. Jonah was just imitating his dad. It seems that Jonah's father, Mike, had worked at an insurance company for almost 10 years and had never received a promotion. Often he would take out his professional frustrations on his family. Jonah took the brunt of his father's anger in the form of frequent spankings and harsh verbal insults. Mike always calls Jonah our good-for-nothing kid, Linda admitted. He's easier on the girls, but with Jonah he's quick to fly off the handle. Our boys are watching us carefully. By the time they're 3 or 4, they have started to notice the disparity between